Welcome to The Message Pod. I'm Nicole Hark. There'd be no surprises in the fact that I'm an avid consumer and participant in the podcasting industry. With podcast listening in Australia continuing to surge and lead market the US showing no signs of abating, our guest in the pod today clearly showed foresight in tapping into the podcast revolution very early. South Australian Russell Ivanovich seems to have an eye for timing. He and his mate Philip Simpson first enjoyed success while toying with a weather app at a time when beginner app developers could still make money. That side gig, as it was at the time, because both were fully employed elsewhere, led to the creation of a fully fledged business in Shifty Jelly. Isn't that a great name? We'll ask about that later. So it's 2008. Podcast listening in Australia was pretty low at the time. But Russell and Philip were keen consumers of this still fresh medium, albeit frustrated by how hard it was to get podcasts on their iPhone. So what do? They create an app, Pocket Casts, a premium podcast listening platform that even came before Apple's own podcast app. Fast forward to 2018, and Shifty Jelly is acquired by four of the most influential podcast creators based in the US. Think NPR, WNYC Studios, WBEZ Chicago, and the group behind the hugely popular podcast, This American Life. What does it mean? Well, as you'll hear, Russell and Philip have made sure to continue to put their values, listeners, producers, and indeed the entire industry of podcasting first and foremost, as they continue their work for Shifty Jelly from an office here in Adelaide. Enjoy our chat with Russell Ivanovich. Hey, Russell, welcome to the pod. It's awesome to have you.
Oh, it's awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's talk about how much life has changed, if indeed it has. And when I say life, I'm talking working life, which I suspect takes up a whole lot of your life. But you've been bought out by four big players in the podcasting space. How has life changed for you?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because from a business perspective, it's changed a lot. Like, there's been so many different things. Because for those of you that aren't familiar with our business, it was two co-founders. So myself and Philip, we sort of founded this. It's a little bit stereotypical. We founded this from our couches at night while having sort of full-time jobs. And it grew into an actual business, right? We employed three other people and we had our own office. But we kind of got to control the entirety of the business. Like, every single decision went through us. And sometimes that was really good. You feel that, you know, I'm controlling this product that's going forward. And other times it's like, I don't want to make decisions about, you know, where this particular thing goes in this particular email. It's like, I don't really care. Like, it'd be nice to have other people to do this for us. So it's made a big difference there. So now we have a CEO. He's based in New York. We have a board from, you know, three people from each of these sort of companies that that bought us out. And so it's a different sort of structure. You know, there's a finance person, there's all that sort of stuff, and there's a little bit more of like a hierarchy. And it's actually been quite beneficial. Like, now when I'm unsure about something, there's more people to bounce things off, there's sort of more levels to go through. And we've got access to the people that actually produce podcasts. So when we have questions about, you know, how do you do this particular thing in the editing schedule or whatever, they can say, hey, you know, I'm so-and-so and I produce Radiolab or something. Like, this is how I do it. And you're like, wow, I never even imagined that, you know, that's how it all worked.
What was the moment of transition like that? That sort of, okay, we're moving into something that is quite huge here. You know, I suppose clicking that switch over and saying, well, things are going to be different.
Yeah.
And you probably never, when you set out with the business, you never saw this, I would imagine, at that point in time, did you?
No, so this is one of the original things Philip and I discussed at the very beginning, because we got a lawyer involved to set up the business and we drafted all the various agreements. And one of the things we talked about is, do we want to sell out? Because, I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate way to set up a business. You know, like, we're going to try and build this, we're going to try and sell to someone bigger, and we're going to do something else. And we both didn't want to. We're like, no, we don't want to. We want to build something, we want to work in it. Some people call that a lifestyle business. I think that's a bit sort of patronizing, but that's the kind of business we wanted to build. And then what happened is, before these people approached us, a few other people did. So quite some big companies in the US came along and said, hey, we like what you've done here with Pocket Casts. Would you consider just selling us the entire product and then sort of joining our development team? And at first we're like, no, like, we wouldn't dream of it. But then you think about it, there's a lot of money on the table and there was some big sort of well-known companies, and we're like, would we? And I think that's what started it sort of ticking in our minds. Like, maybe we would. Like, we both like money. We both like new challenges. You know, would we? And we said no to those initial few sort of offers because they didn't match with what we wanted to do with the product. Like, a lot of them were just about shutting down Pocket Casts and integrating with things they were sort of already doing at these other companies.
Sure.
And then these three sort of not-for-profit, mission-driven, you know, big radio stations in the US came to us with a very different offer. They were like, we want to partner with you. To build sort of the next generation of podcasting platforms for the entire industry. And that just sounded really intriguing. And I think that's when the light bulb sort of moment went off, is like, we can continue building the product that we're already building, but we can now have the resources and backing to do some of these things that we've had on a whiteboard for 3 or 4 years. I'm sure you know what this is like. And you look at them and you're like, I wish I could do that, but I just don't have the time, don't have the resources. And just this light bulb just literally went bing, and I'm like, oh, maybe we can do this stuff now.
Was there a commonality in your thinking between you and your business partner?
There was, thankfully, because I think initially he was a lot more hesitant than I was. Mm-hmm. But I think a few weeks in, we both kind of agreed that this is something we should at least explore. Whereas with some of the previous decisions, I think we were both on the fence. Like, you know, one way or the other way, we weren't really sure. Like, there was no real, I don't know, like, drive to do it. It was like, yeah, we could just ignore these people and keep going on with our lives. But this felt like something very unique. Like, it's not every day that someone actually wants to partner up with you and sort of keep using, you know, what you're good at and sort of add things that they're good at to the mix. And I know that sounds a bit utopian and that's not quite how business works, but it did sound really promising. And they flew us over to, so we went to New York, yeah, and to Washington and sort of various other places in the US. And we got to meet a lot of these people, and they really are genuinely mission-driven. So they're not-for-profit sort of organizations, and they really care about you know, storytelling and journalism and all. And I don't know that these sound sort of like lofty things, but it really impressed us, like, that they were just so focused on doing this one thing, and they were looking for, I guess, a software company to help them with the software side of things. And we're like, that's what we do.
And it feels like the key to that in terms of getting you over the line was that word that you've used several times now, and that's partnership.
Yes, definitely. Because like I said, some of these other companies, they were offering way more money. But they're like, we just want to shut it down. We just want the users. Like, you don't care about that. You take your money and you walk away. And there is something to be said for that. We did briefly consider that. You know, you pay off your house, you do whatever, you go on holidays. But then we're like, no, that's not why we set up this business. So it was about the partnership. And it was also about the mutual respect. So we had a huge amount of respect for them because they produced some amazing, you know, content over there. And the weird thing for us, and this was a little bit, I don't know, ego stroking or something, but they respected us as well. They're like, we really like what you've done with the product. We like this. We like that. We think, you know, you're really amazing at this. And we didn't quite expect that. You don't often get, you know, in a negotiation like that, you don't often get sort of praise coming back the other way. And we're like, oh, wow, like, they know about what we do and they actually appreciate it. Like, that was a big factor in the whole thing.
Tell us about the approach and what that actually looks like, because we all have in our heads this sort of notion of the big guy coming in and wanting to buy another player. It seems to me like it was really respectfully done, but I'm interested in what that actually looks like. Where does the initial contact come from, and who makes it, and how do you progress the conversations?
Yeah, it's interesting because we had no idea what to expect either. So how it initially started is literally an inbox landed in my email overnight. Sorry, an email landed in my inbox, I should say, other way around. And it was just from someone at WNYC. That's the big sort of radio station in New York. And they said, hey, we'd like to, you know, we'd like what you've done here, you know, with this and that. Can we just chat about potential things we could do together? And it was, there was no details in the email. There was no anything like, let's just have a phone conversation and see where it goes. And we thought, why not? We have phone conversations with, you know, podcast producers all the time. This is not unusual. And then very early on in the sort of Skype conversation that we're having, they mentioned the idea of potentially, you know, partnering up to do things together. And I think just the way they sort of approached it, in that, you know, we're not some giant company trying to buy your company. We're looking for partners to work with. Like, is there something that interests you? If it is, you know, let's explore it a bit. And the whole process took a full year, I think, from when they contacted us to when we actually signed an agreement, like 12 months later.
And the idea of staying here based in Adelaide, how much debate centered around that? I mean, how much pressure did you feel to up and take things to the US?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, because if you look at the time zone overlap between especially New York and Adelaide, there is literally none of our working day that overlaps with any of their working day. Like, you get a little bit different in San Francisco. There might be 3 or 4 hours that you can work together, but there was none. So one of their very first questions was, you know, New York's an amazing place. Do you want to come and see it? Like, we'll show you around. Would you consider living here. And both Philip and myself, you know, we've got kids, we've set up sort of families in Adelaide, and we've seen New York. It's not really the kind of city that either of us want to live in. And we just said, you know, look, respectfully, like, we feel like we do our best work here. We enjoy the lifestyle here. Would it be okay if we stayed in Adelaide? And we fully expected them to go, like, we can't work with people in Adelaide. Like, there's no time zone overlap. But they were quite receptive to that. They said, look, we'd prefer you to be in New York, but if you can't be, we're willing to explore this anyway. Which was, yeah, that was very flattering, I think.
That's awesome. And how's it worked out? I mean, how do you day-to-day work with that in terms of those time differences? And I'm interested because at the moment with one of the podcasts we're producing, we speak to the US a lot and we try to set up interviews out of the US and, you encounter those time difference issues, particularly when you're trying to talk to bartenders.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You know, their times of day are completely different for a start anyway. But how has it worked?
It's worked reasonably well. I mean, it's some of the obvious sort of practical things. So we schedule a weekly meeting with our CEO. He sort of takes that at about 9:30 p.m. sort of his time, first thing in the morning for us. Sometimes when we need to talk to partners in New York, we might get up at 11:30 at night and have to do it then. Sometimes stretching into, 1 a.m. in the morning, but that's not really the norm. The cool thing about it is we kind of have two different areas of responsibility. So all the marketing and the business sort of decisions are driven out of New York, and all the software development and the product decisions are here in Adelaide. So it's almost like we're free to develop all day without any sort of interference whatsoever and sort of set our own schedules and do all that sort of thing. And then they're free to, set up all the business relationships and everything else sort of that they're working on over there. And I almost feel like it works better in some ways because I've worked at some big companies where, the CEO is in the same building that you're in and just, a few desks down, and she wants to come down and have a look at, what you're doing. And I understand that excitement, but sometimes it's when you're in the middle of something and you've got a deadline, it's a little bit annoying to have the CEO, standing there peering over your shoulder saying, oh, what about this? What about that? And you're like, yeah, I'm aware of these things. I just need to get this finished. And so you don't have any of that, which... yeah, it's been really interesting. I enjoy it.
The other nicest thing is waking up in the morning and the piece of work's been done overnight.
Exactly. We just hired a support person over in New York, and that's been amazing. So I used to answer all the tweets. We have a support person that does all the emails. And that sometimes felt really exciting and sometimes felt like a burden. You wake up to 150 tweets and you're like, oh, next. But now I wake up and most of them are answered in the time zone of the people that ask the questions. And I'm like, yeah, this is cool.
That's brilliant. Do you think about or allow yourself to think about the inspiration that your story provides to others? I mean, it is a bit cliched when we talk about the Adelaide market and the South Australian market, but when these things happen and when somebody sets out with, or two people set out with really an idea and a dream, and the idea is solid and the heart, let's face it, the hard work is huge. So it doesn't just happen.
Yeah.
That's really, really important to say. But this notion that really you can achieve things on a global scale and it doesn't matter in today's climate where you're based.
Yeah, I think that there's something really rewarding and sort of interesting about that, because Adelaide does, even in Australia, has the stereotypical sort of, it's a little country town and the East Coast is where everything's happening, but...
we kick above our weight,
come on. We do, and not only that, but it doesn't, like you say, it doesn't matter. Like, everybody has an internet connection, like, we can joke about the NBN, whatever, but you have an internet connection, you can talk to people anywhere in the world, and sometimes it's actually nice to be out of that, especially Silicon Valley sort of bubble. You go over there and you meet people in San Francisco and you're like, I don't think you really understand how the rest of the world works. Like, this idea that you have is never, ever going to take off. And they launch it and surprise, like, it doesn't take off. Whereas I feel in Adelaide, we have a lot more of a global perspective. We're just right next to Asia. We've got sort of other countries that America sort of isn't exposed to. And it kind of gives you that global perspective. So I do feel like as long as you're willing to put in the hard work and you have a good idea, like, there's no reason you can't succeed in Adelaide. But I think sometimes people forget about the hard work part.
Absolutely.
As they focus on 10 years later, you achieve this, therefore that, like, all I need to do is that very last bit and I can achieve the same thing. It's like, I don't know.
Let's go back then to the evolution of the business.
Yeah.
And I suppose those early days you talked about starting on the couch and that moment in time also where you went, hang on a minute, we're doing this in our own time.
Yeah.
We're making more money from this than we are from our paid employment. I think it might be time to switch over. Talk us through that period.
Yeah, that was really interesting, because the interesting thing about both Philip and myself is I wouldn't call us traditional sort of entrepreneur type business people. We were extremely risk averse. So we started this while still having full-time jobs, just sort of doing it for the couch. And we did that for a full 2 years. And this is despite having, the number one app in the Australian App Store, which, like you said, was at that time making more income sort of outside our full-time employment than in. And yet we were still really hesitant to make the jump, right? And 2 years in, We had this really weird sort of coincidence. Like, I went on a holiday. Philip also went on a holiday that overlapped with mine a little bit. And we both got back with exactly the same idea without having talked to each other. We're like, we're idiots. Like, we're working like 60 hours a week. Like, there's enough money. Like, let's just put away 3 months worth of income and let's just quit. And I'm like, yeah, I had exactly the same idea. Like, let's do it. And we did. We went to our employers and we said, look, you've been amazing. Like, 4 years here has been, you know, they're really good people to work with, but we want to pursue this thing because we feel like if we don't do it now, there'll never be another opportunity to do something like this. And I think we're right. Looking at the App Store, it kind of crumbled like 3 or 4 years later. Like, we really jumped ship at the right time, not because we're financial or business geniuses. I think we just saw the opportunity. We're like, now's the time. Let's do it.
So what were you doing that others weren't?
I think there was a few things. Like, one was we got in very early. So when we first launched into the App Store, there was 300 apps total in the entire sort of App Store. So that was a huge
leg up. Even to think of that now, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, we're in the millions now.
Yeah.
And I think the other part is we focused on building a quality product because we'd been software developers for, you know, I think 8 or 9 years at that point. I don't want to talk ourselves up, but I feel like we had the experience required to actually build some good things. And we focused on the customers and we're like, what are they asking for? What can we build? What can we do that's interesting that other people aren't doing? And I think we had the skills and expertise to do that. Whereas I think some people make the mistake of, I have a business idea. I'm going to hire any old developer from anywhere and I'm just going to pay the minimum wage and we're going to see where we get. And it's like I get it. There's talented developers all over the world, no doubt about that. But you've got to find ones that are right for your business and that you work well together with and have a shared vision with you. And I think that was a key to it, is that we, because we were developers, we got to work on the actual product that we were building. We didn't have to go through, you know, 3 or 4 layers to get to them. And I think that actually did make a difference, like, in the end.
And the product, for people who perhaps don't understand it, the great thing here in Australia is that the number of people that are now, you know, using podcasts on a daily basis, a weekly basis, is got exponential growth, really.
Yeah.
And if you look at the US market, it still has so much more in it because, of course, we trail in many, many ways. What does it offer to people?
I think the interesting thing about Pocket Casts is the way we think about it is both Apple and Google have a free app that comes pre-installed on your phone, and we think that's a great way to get into podcasting. There's the purple app or the blue app or whatever, tap it, find a few podcasts that you love, you know, listen to them, and we position ourselves that, you know, once you have maybe 5 or 6 podcasts or 10 or 20, I think our average in the app now is like 17 or something that people have, then you start to become a little bit disenchanted with those apps. Like, they're hard to manage, it's hard to find what you want, like, there's a few sort of weird bugs and things in them because they're not really built for that. And at that point, we're like, hey, what about paying some money and getting like something a little bit better? And I think people have really latched onto that sort of premium feel of the app, which has kind of been interesting, is, you know, there's free ones. And then when you want the good one, you come and get Pocket Casts. And then after that, it's just podcasting. Like, it's just on-demand audio. You know, I'm in the car, I'm on the bus. We hear from people all the time. I'm trying to think, there's a guy over in the US, I think drives about 8 hours a day. And he's clocked up, I think, 250 days worth of listening, like, inside of Pocket Casts. And you think, like,
wow. That's
amazing that there's that amount of content out there. But it really, at the end of the day, is about the content. It's just a way to get you the content that you want, like, when you want it.
And do you consider that's part of your success as well, is that you actually care about the content?
Absolutely. And the fact that there's so much good content out there as well. Like, obviously Pocket Casts wouldn't exist if people like yourself and other people sort of around the world weren't producing good quality podcasts that go into there. And I think there's that symbiotic relationship. Like, we have a discovery section where we, you know, we'll feature sort of podcasts and things like that. And we find people can easily get upwards of, you know, 50,000 new subscribers just from being in there. And so there's that symbiosis. Like, we get people new subscribers, we get them the download numbers that they can take to advertisers. And conversely, they get us the amazing content that we get to put into our apps. And I think there's very few other industries where, you know, the relationship is that sort of easy and comfortable, and there's no sort of money changing hands and things like that. I really love that aspect of podcasting.
We talked before about the hard work involved, and obviously going back in time, version one just kind of plodded along. Is
did,
that
yes.
fair to say?
Oh, it, less than plodded along. It was a
I was
complete
being polite.
Disaster.
All right, I don't need to be polite then.
No, because this was 2010. The concept of listening to a podcast on your phone didn't really exist because you had to sync your phone with iTunes, you had to get MP3 files. It was
nightmare.
Really, I was a developer, like, I know all about computers, really complicated. And sometimes you forget to sync it and you're like, well, now I have no content. And we had this crazy idea. There was no apps in the store. We're like, let's just build a podcasting app. And at the time, Apple was actively rejecting them as well, which made it even more fun. They're like, no, we do podcasting on iTunes. Like, you can't do that. I'm like, okay,
I like
thanks.
Your reference made it even more fun. That's awesome.
Well, it did. It felt like a challenge, right? And yes, we released version one and we're like, look, everybody, like, you can get podcasts on your phone. Everyone's like, yeah, like, that's nice. And I guess we had no marketing strategy. We had I guess we've just been so used to being successful in the Australian market with our weather app that we've been working on for a few years at that point, that it really never entered into our heads that, like, how on earth are you going to get this noticed in places like the US? Like, we just didn't think about it. We launched it, we told a few people, and then no one noticed. And we're like, what happens now? What's going on?
Crickets.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we go through to sort of version 2 and version 3. What was the monumental shift? Can you actually define that in terms of when it started to get noticed?
We can, actually. There's a distinct point in time when people first, the majority of people first found our app, is when we did something different. We're like, okay, we've been doing this for a few years now. We've had zero success. The weather app is paying for, like, all our development. But if this thing doesn't succeed soon, like, we have to move on to something else because you're not going to be able to sell a weather app forever. Like, that's proven true. And so we looked at it and we saw this new thing called Android in the market. And we had a lot of customers saying, hey, I want an Android app. I want an Android app. Can you make an Android app? Neither of us had Android phones. And we're like, can we make an Android app? Like, I mean, we can try. And then we had another crazy idea is, like, let's not just make an Android app. Let's actually make that before the next version of our iOS app. So this is, I think, version 4, I want to say. I'm sort of stretching my memory here. But we actually worked on the Android app first, and we sort of built that as a bit of a marketing ploy for people. We went to a lot of websites and we said, you know, hey, look, we're building an Android app first. No one else is doing it. We think this is the future of the mobile market. Everybody else disagrees with us, like, interesting story, maybe. And it turned out that it really was. Like, everything from, you know, the really Apple-focused sort of tech sites all the way to the Android enthusiasts, like, they all just lapped it up. They're like, this is really interesting. I think they all thought we were going to fail. They thought it was, like, you know, one of those interesting, quirky stories and, you know, good luck with it, whatever. But the fact that it got noticed by so many people just because of that sort of quirk is suddenly what shot sales up instantly, like, literally instantly overnight. And it was for both the Android version that we just released and for the iOS version as well, which is really interesting. Just the fact that people found out that this existed and then they went to the App Store and they paid for it. Like, that's all it took. And it's like, ooh, interesting.
And is that the notion of being talked about?
Yes.
I mean, you know, talkability.
Yes.
And that just takes off, right?
Exactly. And this is something you're intimately familiar with, like, more so than I am. But it was very naive of us to think that we could get that organically. Like, I think there's this concept when, you know, let's say you're a creative person or a technical person and you build a good product, you're like, that's all I need to do. I build a good product, I put it into the market, that's all it takes. That's the cleanest way to do something, and I don't have to dirty myself with this marketing stuff.
Wouldn't that be an awesome world?
It is, but the reality is that marketing is super important, and it's not a dirty word. Like, it doesn't have to be, like, you know, unhanded or whatever. There are plenty of ways to market things that, you know, that are in your customer's interest and in your interest. And we've discovered that so many times, like, you know, since that point, it's like you learn that lesson over and over again.
Part of what you were talking about then was resilience as well. I mean, hard work, clearly, but also understanding that you're up against it a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And when it gets tough, you can't just give up. I mean, you're sitting back, you've spent all these hours, all this investment in a product that you believe in, but it's not going anywhere.
No.
And that notion that we've got more to do here. So you've got to be able to sort of stay at the grind, don't you? And that is a difference between success and trying.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not just our story. You hear that so many times that people try something for many, many, many years. It doesn't work. And then it pays off. In our case, I think it was 2 years of development that we'd invested in this thing, which is, that's not a small amount of time. Two years of
sure.
your life. Like, you know, you chop that up and it's like, that's a lot of time. And we did think about just throwing in the towel, but we're like, I think there's something here. This podcasting thing, we're both huge fans. We see so many other people are fans of podcasting and we think it's going to grow. It wasn't really super obvious at that point, but we're like, maybe we just got to stick with this and we just got to keep losing money until eventually we figure out a way to break into the market. And yeah, we did. It was really interesting. Like, people forget that sort of 2 years of hard work that came before that. And it's not just 2 years of hard work. It's 2 years of looking at sales daily, downloading them, seeing like $5, $4, $3 and being like, is this ever going to increase?
Yeah. Thankfully, the answer was yes.
Yes.
you said when you came in, oh, like, I'm tired.
Yes.
And that's because you're still working hard.
Yes. Yeah, I think some people get this impression that you sell out and then you go off and live on a boat or something. I don't know how true that
is. Are you not
doing that? No, I don't even have a boat. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because now we're working not harder than ever, but we're working just as hard as we always have, even though we've staffed up. So now on every single team, we almost have double sort of the development talent that we did before. But there's still a lot of stuff to do. And now we're more ambitious in the things that we're chasing. And so the weird part about it is we're actually still working just as hard. But I think we still both, and the rest of the company, I assume, as well, want to be working just as hard. Because now we're chasing something bigger. And we really want to hit all these targets that we've set. We're like, if we can do this, like, I think this could actually be like a really cool thing in the market.
So it's the passion and the excitement is what you're really talking about. It's still very real. It's still there. What does the future look like for you? Do you imagine a future?
We imagine sort of the next sort of 1 or 2 years. I like really not to think past that because I think some people, they're like, what are you going to be doing in 5 years? I'm like, no one really knows.
Yeah,
you can come up with business plans and whatever, but 2 years from now, like, that's all going to change. So I think the next 1 or 2 years, like, we really have that sort of mapped out in our heads and on whiteboards and in various documents. And I really hope we get to that future where, you know, podcasting is more popular, it's more ubiquitous, there's more people doing it, there's more, I guess, interesting sort of monetization models in podcasting that just aren't necessarily all about advertising, like about doing sort of different things as well. And that's the future we're kind of driving towards. If 2 years from now, like, I'm sitting here and it didn't work out, I think that's okay. Like, we want to try it. And maybe that's something you don't get a lot of in Australia, is I think we're a little bit failure-averse or scared of failure. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to the US and they don't care. It's like, I failed at three businesses, but the fourth one succeeded. Everyone's like, congratulations. But in Australia, it's like, I failed at my business. It's like, oh, really? Did you? Like, you poor thing. Like, you have to go back to full-time work, or you got to go to McDonald's and work there or something. Like, it's not that bad. Like, as long as you're in an industry that, you know, that there's work, you can always go and get other work. Like, failing, I think, is fine. And that's kind of the attitude we have now, is we're going to try some ambitious things. We really hope they work out. But if they don't, you know what? Well, at least we tried.
Can you share with us what you're working on?
Not the specific details, but...
Oh, come on. What's on the whiteboard?
Well, there's an obvious thing that I think people are going to be coming across in the short term, is we've been working on version 7 of our product. So this is something that's been in the pipeline, I think, for a full year now. So this is an iOS app, an Android app, you know, web version. We're on sort of various other platforms as well. And that's why I'm tired at the moment, because I've been working sort of nonstop towards that. But then sort of the next 6 to 12 months, we have some really interesting things that we're exploring in the monetization space. So we feel like advertising, I think, is... It's not a solved problem, but there's a lot of people solving the problem of how do you advertise on podcasts and how do you make money advertising. And so the place we'd like to explore is there other ways to make money with a podcast that are not necessarily advertising? Not because advertising is bad, like that model exists, it's there, it's fine, use it if you want to, but just trying to figure out if there's other ways to bring more money into the podcasting space for producers specifically, which... That's been interesting. Now that we work with all these big producers, there's a lot more producer focus sort of going into things that we just didn't have before, because that wasn't our world.
Yeah, you were more at the consumer
level. Exactly, yeah.
And so now you've expanded that and looking at both.
Yeah.
The synergy between the two, because without the monetization, the production doesn't occur ultimately.
I don't think some people realize how much money and time and sort of effort goes into producing a podcast. Like,
did I roll my eyes?
Like, if you hear something that sounds amazing and is really compelling and whatever, it's not because someone sat down in front of a microphone, banged it out in their, you know, basement or whatever, and then left to go to work. It's because they spent time, you know, writing a script or doing whatever, and then doing heavy editing and then throwing away the bits that didn't sound good. And that takes money. Like, if you want people to keep doing that as maybe not like their full-time job or their part-time job, there has to be money in it, because if there's not, like, who's going to keep doing that long-term? Like, nobody.
Mm. And you obviously working now with some of the very big players in the market, but there is also smaller independent players, and a healthy market requires both of those things.
Absolutely.
And so it's interesting when we look at it, and I note some of the comments you've made in some of the pieces of media you've been quoted in, where you express some concern about the Netflix style of podcasting and where it might head.
Yeah.
Explain to us what you mean by that.
So I look at examples like Netflix and YouTube, which are, to be fair, huge wins for the consumer. So you go to YouTube, you can watch almost any content you want from, you know, all your favorite sort of small producers. And then if you want sort of higher production value TV/movies type stuff, potentially go to Netflix. And that has worked out really well for consumers, but terrible for publishers. Because if you look at the kind of money they're making and the kind of agreements they have to sign and how often those agreements change. Like, there was a thing with YouTube, I think, roughly 12 months ago, where they completely just changed their search and ranking algorithm. And suddenly some people just stopped making money overnight. And these were people who were doing this as a full-time job, making good money, making good content. Suddenly they disappeared and there's no one to go to. Like, YouTube doesn't care. They're like, you know, like, there's millions of people producing content. Like, what do you matter? And I think that's a really interesting thing that a lot of audio producers are trying to avoid. We want the ubiquity. We want people to easily be able to play stuff. We don't want them to, you know, have a million hurdles before they can hit play on a podcast. But we don't necessarily want one central organization who's for profit running that whole system, because I think at the end of the day that hurts producers more than it helps.
And it seems to me that was an important part in your decision in terms of selling your business, was that not-for-profit ethos with the companies that you ultimately are now partnering with.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's the biggest thing that drew us to it. And not just that, but the fact that they also wanted to help every other producer in the space as well. Because the thing we were initially worried about is, okay, you're the four biggest producers of content over in the US, you're public radio. Do you care about anything that's not public radio? Because the perception from the outside is no, public radio is public radio. But when you talk to the people inside there, they do. They care about the small producers of podcasts and how they can sort of make money as well. So that's kind of refreshing to me also, that we're not just a public radio app that serves public radio content. We're still trying to sort of make a platform and an app just for the entire market.
What do you see as the future of podcasting?
Oh, that's a big question.
It's a huge question. Have a go.
I mean, some of the obvious stuff is it's growing. All the market research we get tells us it's growing. More people know what a podcast is. More people have listened to a podcast on a daily basis. I think it's going to continue to grow. That part seems obvious. You know, it's on-demand audio. It's very convenient. I look at the way my kids, they're sort of 10 and 12, the way mm-hmm. they consume content now. They have no concept of scheduled programming whatsoever. We went on holidays once and there was a TV, you know, we turned it on at 7 o'clock to keep them quiet or whatever. And they're like, I don't want to watch this. I want to watch something else. And I'm like, this is all there is. Like, you can't skip forward. You can't. And they're like, what? And they just did not get the concept of scheduled programming. And I think that's going to really explode in the podcasting space, that people in general, once they've been exposed to on-demand audio, I think a lot of people like it. And I think the other part of it is we really as an industry have to figure out how to monetize better. And I know that sounds a bit sort of businessy and corporate, but the fact is, if there's not enough money flowing through for producers to make good money and make good content and expand the kind of content that they're making, then eventually this industry will collapse. Like, all that will be left is the big players with the big budgets that might potentially, you know, have big radio stations behind them or whatever else, and everyone else would disappear. We saw that happen in the app space. So 2008 to 2010, so many independent app developers like everywhere. And then 2010 to 2014, they all went and got full-time jobs because the market just disappeared on them. And it was that whole sort of drive to the bottom. Everyone was trying to make free sort of engaging content. And if everything is free, then at the end of the day, there's no content. Like, 4 years later, the amount of good apps made by independent developers is almost non-existent now.
What about the notion of open versus closed platforms?
Yeah, that's an interesting one as well, because, you know, obviously YouTube, Netflix, very closed. You know, you got to sign an agreement with Netflix to be on Netflix. You got to, and same thing with YouTube. You got to agree to all their terms and you've got to be subject to them. I think the interesting part of podcasting at the moment is very open. Like, if I want to put out a podcast, all I need to do is make this, RSS feed thing that I put up on the internet somewhere, and suddenly every single podcast client in the world has access to my content. It doesn't matter what my content is, where I host my content. Like, I get to choose all those different things. And no one really filters that either. Like, you know, I can put it wherever I want. I can be on whatever platform I want. I really like that aspect of podcasting, is that anyone who wants to produce something can put it out there. And I think that's something we'd really like to preserve. Like, I think one of the worst things that could happen to this industry is if suddenly one sort of giant company controlled the whole thing and said, you know what, we don't like Australia anymore. No Australian content, like, in this store, which I know that's an extreme example. I'm not trying to be realistic here, but it's that difference between just everybody being able to publish things versus, you know, going through one central company to having to publish. And that's really scary for me. And it's not just me. I think the people that invested in us are also worried about that sort of future. Like, they want to keep the medium open so that they can also keep publishing their content without, you know, restrictions.
Brilliant. Music to my ears. Shifty Jelly, where did the name come from? You probably get sick of being asked that.
People ask this a lot. And I think, okay, it is a quirky name.
But I love the name.
Yeah. It's quite weird. You know, this is very sort of developer-y. So what we did is we had a whiteboard.
Well, you are a developer.
That's true. And so we wrote down a whole bunch of adjectives, and then we wrote down a whole bunch of animal names. And we had some rules. For example, Philip, my co-founder, was completely against the use of the word monkey. He's like, developers are monkeys. Like, what is it? Just no monkeys. Like, you can't. So he's like, no, nothing to do with monkeys. So we looked through them all, and we combined all these words. And then the other thing we were thinking about is we were full-time sort of enterprise developers, and we didn't want our employer to feel like we were trying to steal their clients and, you know, start some other competing sort of enterprise business. So we're like, all right, it has to be like an adjective with an animal name. It has to be quirky. And we just ran through all these different sort of names, and we got to like Shifty Jelly. And I think we both just really liked that idea of just like a shifty looking jellyfish, you know, with their eyes sort of like askew, just like looking like, you know, potentially they were going to steal something from your house, or they're just sort of, you know, hanging out like on a, you know, in a dark alley or something. I really like this concept. We got a designer to sort of, you know, prototype a few logos, and we're like, yes, like Shifty Jelly, that's what we want.
And yet it's funny because the word shifty seems so juxtaposed with the characters behind this, who seem actually intent on I think moralistic outcomes to a degree. I mean, I know that's probably the wrong reference point, yeah. but it feels to me like what you do and how you do it is really important to you, and that you are doing things that are respectful of others.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. Complete opposite of being shifty, of course.
But that's another thing. We, at the time, we had no idea we were starting a full-time business. We were just trying to have a bit of fun on the side, and the name was meant to reflect that. It did get interesting later on when that started to appear in a lot of legal documents. You know, we were signing agreements to provide our weather feed to like various companies, and it was like, you know, Shifty Jelly Proprietary Limited, and we're like, yeah, that looks pretty weird.
You did things from the start professionally, though, didn't you? I mean, you said, oh, you know, I don't know where this was going to go. We chose the name at this point in time. But you talked about engaging a designer. You talked about getting lawyers involved. I mean, everything from the beginning felt like it had a destiny. I mean, you took it seriously.
Yeah, I don't want to pretend like it was very casual and we just sort of fell into it. We did think about a lot of that stuff. And especially when setting up a company, we did get lawyers involved because we thought, we have to cover all the different angles. Like, what if, you know, Philip, my co-founder, what if he wants to leave and he wants to do something else? What if I want to leave? What if someone wants to sell half their shares? Or, you know, what if this happens? And we tried to, I hate to say like a prenuptial sort of marriage agreement, but in a business, you need that sort of stuff. Like, we tried to just set up all the different conditions and just make it super clear that if this outcome, you know, eventuates, this is how we're going to handle it. And we also recognize that we have no design skills whatsoever. I won't show you the picture, but at one point, Philip tried to draw some assets for our weather app and they looked extremely funny. And at that point, we're like, okay, neither of us are designers. We recognize that to build a professional product, you need someone who's a professional at design. And so we just hired someone. We're like, this is obvious, this is what we have to do. We don't have a business if we don't hire a designer. So we just did. And I think there is some level of foresight in that. It's not just complete accident that, you know, we ended up where we were. So, yeah, I don't want to give people that impression either.
No, absolutely. It has been a real delight catching up with you, chance to chew the fat, so to speak. We always ask somebody that comes onto the program the question about, if you could leave a message with our audience, what would it be? And it could be something from business, it could be something from life, but if you had the opportunity, let's say it might even be a message that you would want your children to adopt or to take on, it could be anything. I'm going to leave it open to you.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, I have thought about this a little bit. I think it's a two-part thing and it's very short, and I think we've touched on both of these things in the interview. I think the one thing I would try and tell other people, and also potentially pass back to, you know, past Russell or whatever, if you want to talk about it like that, is one, marketing is not a dirty word. Like, marketing, super important. Like, don't forget about that. If you've invested so much of your time into building a product, invest similar amounts of time in marketing. Like, treat it seriously. And the other one is to not be afraid of hard work. I think some people sort of see success stories and whatever, and they're like, I just want the success. I want instant success, and I want it now, and I get that, like everybody does. But sometimes it takes years and years of work. I think you got to be prepared for that. So if you're going to jump off and do your own thing, like, just be prepared for years and years of hard work. I think that's how you start most businesses. That there's no real sort of magic or secret. It's those two things. You combine them, and you get something good.
Brilliant. I'm glad we've explored both of those themes today. I'm going to let you get back to work.
Yes.
Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for spending it with us.
No, thank you.
Cheers. I tell you what, Russell's talents extend well beyond being a developer. It's fair to say he's proven himself as a trailblazer. Not necessarily a title you'd hear him using, but he's also a fabulous storyteller. And perhaps that's one of the reasons he enjoys such a strong connection with the podcast industry. If you'd like to listen to more inspiring conversations, head to themessagepod.com.au or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Nicole Hark. Till next time.